This is a Collider.com audio interview.
He made a lot of his films and from here, including Amadeus, and recorded a lot of the records he produced over the years here, a lot of jazz greats and Creedence Clearwater Revival and so forth. We got this space for our art department and editorial offices when we were starting out. We needed some space, and we thought this had a good local vibe. And the Pixar Daycare is here as well, so it all just gels beautifully. I had a chance to talk to you, many of you, last night at least. I'm Jim Morris, and I'm producing John Carter of Mars. You may have met Colin Wilson, those of you who got a chance to go to the set in Utah. Colin did the a lot of the production of the principal photography, and Lindsay Collins, my producing partner, is primarily focused on the visual effects. She couldn't be here today with us, unfortunately, but the three of us are working on the show together. We're very excited to show you some of the stuff we have today. Andrew's going to go over many things of the show and give you a rundown. Just to be clear, Andrew and I are both Pixar employees. Andrew, in addition to directing and writing there, is the VP of creative there, and I'm the general manager at Pixar. But John Carter of Mars is a Walt Disney picture. It's a live action picture. It's not a Pixar film. It's not an animated film. It's not a G or PG rated film, probably a PG-13, so there are battles and dismemberments and things such as that. Not suitable for small children. We are going to show you materials here, but we are going to take a trip over to Pixar since we're so close, and we have some stuff set up over there to show you, and we'll have lunch over there, and you get a little bit of a look around while we're here. I'd like to introduce Andrew. Many of you know him already. Andrew has been a key creative force since the beginning of Pixar. He's written a number of the films here, Toy Story films, Bug's Life, where he's co-director, Monsters, writer and director of Finding Nemo and WALL-E. And he is a great cinephile, music aficionado, great friend, partner, writer, director of John Carter, Andrew Stanton.
Okay.
As I said, it's a little bit like Christmas. I can't wait to show some of this stuff. We've been working for so long on this thing. A lot of people don't realize I've actually started working on this in 2006, so it's been a long, long haul, and I still got a little under a year to go. So kind of nice to release a little steam and give you a little window. Okay, so let's get started. How many of you guys actually know anything about the property that this is from? Okay, like half of you. Okay, good. Well, then this won't be preaching to the choir too much. I just want to give you a little insight into it. A lot of people seem to remember this. This is a Frank Frazetta painting from the late 60s, very popular on vans in the 70s. this icon's existed in people's memory way more than the actual property it's derived from. And next year will be the actual 100th anniversary of the novelization of the first book of this series of books called Princess of Mars. And believe me, that fact didn't get lost on me at the time that I asked to possibly do this film. I thought, wouldn't it be fitting to have a film that's actually 100 years in the making be made on the 100th anniversary? So that was a little bit of a carrot to try to see if we could get it done for that time. It was actually 100 years ago. It was first publicized in serial form in February of 1912 in a magazine called the All-Star Magazine, and the title of it was at the time called Under the Moons of Mars. It was a serial adventure magazine. It was sort of what you had before there were movies. It was cliffhangers. You would sort of have the next chapter that would lead you to buy the next magazine. And it received its proper publication as a novel with Edgar Rice Burroughs finally owning up to being the author of it, under the title Princess of Mars in 1912. And since then, it has literally inspired tons of things. It inspired, you know, novelists and movie makers and astrologists, and some directly and some indirectly. To completely forthcoming, though, my initial introduction to this property was through this. It was a comic book form, short run of it in the 70s. And I had my best friend, like most of us, my best friend was a latchkey kid, and who had all these older brothers, and it was nothing but a comic haven in their attic. And I remember being introduced to this, and they all used to draw, and they would draw these Tharks all the time. And I got sort of, from there, turned on to find out about the books that they were from, and I started to read them. And I started to read them from cover to cover from sort of my junior high school years, bleeding into my high school years. And my friends that were girls used to tease me and call them my romance novels. And so everybody seems to know Tarzan, and most associate, I gotta go back, guys.
There's no judging here.
Yeah, I know. Everyone knows. Oh, geez, it won't stay. Everyone knows Tarzan, and most associate. Let me see if I can read it real quick. Bam, bam, bam. Okay. Well, everybody seems to know Tarzan. Not many people know these books, even though I felt that they were a little bit more compelling for me. I guess I just wasn't into the jungle ape thing as much. And there were 11 books actually written over a period of years. And that's why I was introduced to this, was as a series. And so most people know me at Pixar as the guy that doesn't like to do sequels or is very reluctant to do sequels. And it wasn't, the irony wasn't lost to them when I asked them to do this first book, to option the first three. And I said, I really want to try to attack it, the first three, like a trilogy, and give us a fighting chance to introduce it to the world the way it was introduced to me, which was as an ongoing series with a promise of something going on. Not as a cold, crass franchise, but just as, again, to try to capture what I felt as a young kid when I got introduced, that there was already 11 books, and they were my Harry Potters, I guess. And so I wanted to see if we could do the same, get off on the right foot with this one. So, they were very receptive to that fact, and that's exactly what we did. And then, so we attacked all three, knowing that the first one was really going to be the only promise of what could be made, and whether if it succeeds and if it does well, then we'll move on. But I was very sensitive as an audience member to films that are part of a trilogy. They're often, they don't end well. They're not, they're episodic in a bad way, and I want, I guess the terms I tried to use was I wanted them interlinked but independent. I wanted them to be able to stand on their own. I wanted it that if you came on film two, you'd be able to not have seen film one. If you came on film one, you aren't demanding that you have to have film two to be satisfying. And that's easy to say, hard to do. And but I felt that I've experienced that before in the rare occasions with certain television episodes and with certain movies, and that was the worthy holy grail to try to shoot. So once we had this scope in mind, we sort of put all our efforts onto the first book, Princess of Mars. Now, I know I'm going to get this question all day and probably for the rest of my freaking life. why John Carter? Well, this has had quite an evolution of me figuring out what was the best thing to do for this book to preserve what I thought was timeless about it, what I thought was the resonant elements about it, but not be afraid to tweak or alter things for the benefit of it so that it would translate the best it could up to the screen. Nobody's a bigger fan of these books, I think, than me, or at least I could match myself with a lot of people. But I'm also a huge cinephile, and I have witnessed that to honor the book literally word for word never makes a good movie. And so how can I somehow do that and make you feel like how it felt to read the books when you're watching the movie? You have to be willing in private to be able to sort of dismantle it all, put it apart, break it apart, analyze it, and look at it almost objectively as if you were just making this from scratch, and then see what comes back together. It's actually not that different than when you have to rewrite anything that you've done once you've done a first draft. And in doing so, I also found that This is the wrong crowd to be to probably get this, but not everybody's into sci-fi. And I've tried really hard to capture what I thought was universal and timeless about this book that is above and beyond the genre itself. And I don't want to exclude anybody from a wrong first impression assumption about this movie or this property. And so I didn't want to lie and say it isn't what it is. So I said, well, let's just sell the character that we've put all our efforts towards. And believe me, Mars is going to come into this thing, title and everything, before this whole journey's over. You just got to be patient. So there is a grand design to all this thinking. That's the most I want to say, because I don't want to spoil it even for you guys. So you've just got to know that it was not a studio-driven hammer on me. It was, and it was not a decision that came quickly. A lot of thought into what's the most promising way to make a good first impression to a majority of the world that does not know anything about this, and invite them in and hopefully make them enjoy it as much as the people that do love it. So that's the best way I can put it. I've been following the Hollywood trail of this movie almost being made since I was a kid. It's weird still to be on the other side of this thing, because all I've ever wanted is to see it on the screen. Somebody please do it. Somebody please make it. And I remember reading about possibly being animated in the 30s, and that Ray Harryhausen tried to do it in the 50s, and that John McTiernan almost did it in the 80s, and that they just didn't have the technology or the means to figure out how to freaking translate it visually. And then certainly once I was in the know with the filmmaking community, I was always two or three separations away from people that I heard were possibly working on development of it. It would almost get made and almost get made. And couldn't believe it when it finally just found itself back to the estate. And here I was already starting to think of, well, what do I want to do next, even though I was in the middle of WALL-E, that's when I start thinking about that. And made a call. Again, don't take it lightly that... for the fans of this is on my shoulders. But I'm just staying true to what I wanted to see all my life. And I can't, and frankly, that's the most insurance I've ever had on anything I've ever worked on, is that you'd have to stop me from getting out of bed to work on it. That's my best insurance policy. I met a couple people along the way that turned out to be just as avid that I was already working with, that we just turned out to have an equal love. Mark Andrews, you met last night. Mark Andrews is head of story on Incredibles. He was thinking about working on another project at Pixar, and when I came to sort of hear what his ideas were, I used a John Carter analogy, and he just stopped in his tracks and goes, "You know John Carter?" And then we started geeking out on each other, and sort of made this little pinky swear that if we ever got to work on it, we would pull the other one in, and kept that pinky swear. And so he and I wrote on that together, and then I made friends with Michael Chabon through the Nemo years, more of an acquaintance, and then was needing another writer, and somebody, and Michael just doesn't live too far from here. And he and I were sort of like, somebody said, I was at a Christmas party, I think he was at, and somebody came back that was working on the development for this, and he goes, "You know, he's a huge fan of the books." And I said, "Oh my gosh, what was I thinking?" And I called him up thinking, there's no way he's going to have the time or the ability. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning author, oh my gosh. And he said, "Where do I sign?" And we immediately started working. And we found out right away that all of us had this similar link. We had all drawn pictures as kids that we still had that we could prove that we were fans since we were little. So I had mine from when I was 12, and I drew way too light. It's really hard to see that. And so these were my Tharc drawings. And then Michael brought his in, and he even gave himself Edgar Rice Burroughs' name. And Mark is a bastard because he could draw this good when he was 10. And I can't believe that. But, and again, he brought his in, and just to prove that, we started to make this rule, like, I can't work on this film unless you can prove it, that you did. But it was a nice connection for the three of us that allowed us to have sort of a bond together working on this, and to trust each other to just at least in the safety of our writing room and in the production, just think outside the box and then come back in and It was a really, I would have never guessed this trio would be a trio or that it would work well, but it works very well when the three of us are in a room together. And we work very well independently. We're all very busy people, so we're all very good at being able to take somebody's stuff from remotely and plus it, critique it, and bounce it back and forth. So much has been derived from this book over 100 years that my first dilemma was, how the hell do you make this and not look like you're being derivative yourself? And it wasn't until I had Nathan Crowley, who was a production designer on all of Nolan's film, and it was lucky that he was free for a while. He kind of came in, and I wanted somebody that was not a fantasy sci-fi guy. I wanted somebody that would think more literally about. He comes more from an architectural background, and just how you would really attack some of these things. How would a different world come up with doors and windows, not necessarily the way we would do it, that kind of challenge. And he had one of his guys mock up, when I was on a rant, like I usually am describing something, about how I wanted it to feel and stuff, he had somebody mock up this image. And it was totally the touchstone for me. I said, that's what I want. I want to feel like I'm really there. I want to feel like it's really happening. And this is not what somebody wished for. This is what really happened. And this is the source of the book. And then I realized that's what it is. It's a period film of a period we just don't know about. It's as if somebody has done their Martian history research really, really well and called in all the authorities. And I said, that's the way to approach this. I don't want it to seem like this is images of creatures that people have been drawing on their notebooks their whole life and just want to selfishly see realized on the screen. I want you to go, no, sorry, this is actually how people dressed in Aztec times, or this is how people bartered in Japanese feudal times. And can we capture that faux authenticity, which is, an oxymoron, I guess. But, so that breaking that down, it was making things weathered, aged, having limitations, a sense of deep-seated culture that you don't really ever get to explore to the depths you'd like to, a sense that much has gone on in the world long before the times that we're present to. And so setting the time period on Earth to match the books helped. I set the time period on Earth to be what the books were. And it really helps, I think, put you in a past mentality for both planets, which I think was a real helpful way to make it feel fresh. So we did exactly that. We looked at Petra in Jordan was a real inspiration. And we came up with this epiphany, and I don't know for how many of you guys came to the Utah set, but you were on one of the examples of what we were trying to do, which was picking land masses that truly exist and just doing the tiniest Photoshop tweak to them. And they become man-made or Martian-made. And that way, when you watch the film, it feels real. A large percentage of the screen space that you're watching is actual, truly been photographed. And it will hopefully help give it a sense of believability that I really wanted out there. This is an actual set location, and this is what we're doing with it. Same, another angle. And for those of you on the Utah set, and this is if you remember, this is ultimately what will happen to it. And it's having the effect we hoped it would of just where the hell did they find this place to shoot it? On a parallel track, at the same time, my other main issue was how do I deal with these archetypal characters? These four main characters, in particular the two of John Carter and Deja Thoris. Character was probably my biggest focus on the project. I needed to dimensionalize these heroes. Carter's pretty much a do-gooder through most of these books. Can be very vanilla, very two-dimensional at times, and Deja was too much of a damsel in distress. I mean, you got to remember, these sort of were the fresh adventure ideas at the time that became tropes. And could I make both characters make a little bit more of them, but still retain what I felt was an innate sense of justice in Carter and a strength of Mars at the core of Deja? So after many casting calls and an elaborate week of film tests, I found my two heroes, and I really struck gold. Taylor Kitsch as Carter, and Lynn Collins as Deja Thoris. Taylor plays damaged goods really well, and he was such a the thing I lucked out on was he is such a pantomime with things that aren't there. I kept calling him my modern-day Bob Hoskins. I mean, he just he could act against nothing, and when that was required of him, as if it was just there. And that was an added bonus to what I was already getting with him. And Lynn was really not on my radar, and she came in with an inner strength and a demanding intelligence that I could not ignore and felt just translated on the screen incredibly well. And neither are hard to look at, so that doesn't hurt. And neither of them are incredibly familiar faces yet. And that's a big thing for me, too, if I can have any say, is that I want to believe they are who they're playing. And if you're going to play these characters that are going to be possibly seen again and again, it would be great to get off on the right foot and think that you just can fall in belief that they are who they are. And I just, that's all I ever want when I go with something. I just want to be sucked in and I just want to believe. Casting the other two main characters was an entirely different challenge. They are Tharks in this book. Tharks are 9 foot to 10 foot tall green aliens with four arms and tusks. And they're all CG. So I went with my Pixar gut and experience and got actors because of their eyes, their voice, and their acting ability. Because that's all that's going to be left when all this is said and done. Those are three things that can translate directly to the animated characters once they're portrayed there. And so I got Willem Dafoe and Samantha Morton, and this is what I asked them to do, which was to be on stilts with gray pajamas on, with face cams, and in 100 degree heat. And that's how I sold it. I didn't know how else to sort of get around this issue. And so I said, how would you like to wear gray pajamas and be on stilts and wear face cams and stand in 100 degree heat in the middle of the desert for 6 months or 3 months? And they said, where do I sign? I think it was just being honest with the challenge and that it was different than things that they had done before, that they were really up for seeing where this would go. And the reason I really, really wanted to do this is because, at least for me, I can tell when somebody's acting to a tennis ball or nothing there versus somebody's really being I, again, wanted every possible chance to make this believable. So by having them really there, people acted better, people acted differently, people had actual eye lines, people reacted and to things that they weren't prepared for, and even down to the cameraman framed differently because there was somebody there. And cameramen are trained to frame nicely. So if you take something out of the background and have nothing there, they're going to use the background, whether they know it or not, to try to frame, to make that look balanced and good. And when you have somebody actually there, they're willing to be sloppier and do all the stuff they would normally do. So all these things, so I learned a lot of this working on WALL-E, and I just, this all added up to a hopefully a very visceral, believable sense of something really being there that you're talking to and acting to. And so it seemed like so that's exactly what people did. So we were out there with we were actually out there with the gray pajamas, standing on stilts with a face cam, using the face cam. The face cams actually turned out to be great for the actors because they could just treat them as if they were the tusks, and they could use them for the actual distance that they had to be from things. And that was a real benefit. And then you'd get into weird situations like this where you'd have green people making sure they're not going to fall over and doing your scene. And there's actually going to be a huge crowd in that shot. And I would stand out on days like this and go, what the fuck was I thinking? And I am just, this is either going to pay off or I am just going to, what's a way to go? This is one way to go out. And, I swear, now that I'm seeing the end product, finally getting finished shots on the other side. If I were to shoot again tomorrow, I would do it all over again exactly this way. It was the right call. It was the right way to be. And I think Amy can attest to that. You were out there for the whole damn thing.
Yeah, it was good.
Very So they even had Thark-on-Thark action, you know, where we would have, you know, technically that could just be a plate with nobody acting, but we realized, you know, no, we want it, this has been great, this is great reference for animators. Coming from the animation ranks really gave me an insight to how much you'd want to have as the animator, because the way I treat it is whoever's cast as your animator is your actor, and you've got to treat them the way you would treat your other actors. And you've got to cast them as smartly as you would cast actors. And they're going to ask the same questions and need the same context and the same know-how that any actor is going to have. And so to see a scene played out by two actors and all the choices made that are ultimately going to be taken over by one or two animators is gold. You can't replace that. So we would go through the pain of doing this. And even when it came time to writing the thoughts, we actually went to the pain of figuring out what a thought looked like, animating it, figuring out what the lope of it and the gallop of it was, and then programming that data into an electrical cart so that the saddle would move exactly at that, so that hopefully when it was all done and you put a thark on there and you put a thought in it, that real saddle would match. And it does. And so hopefully if you've done it right, people will go, how the hell are they sitting on this thing and how the hell are they riding around on this thing? Again, all in the desire to just believe that it's really happening, it's really there. Because it's all I wanted as a kid when I was reading it, is to be there. And the last piece of the puzzle was making sure that the manner and look of how everyone spoke in this world wasn't silly. It's very heightened prose. And so I decided to surround everybody with the most seasoned actors, a lot of them British, that I could. I would often make fun of the dialogue and call it pulp Shakespeare. And just wanted to make sure that when they say something out of their mouths, there was gravitas to it, that you would believe it, that you would buy it. Just trying to retain the spirit and innocence of the books without anything becoming laughable. I've kind of given you where I came from, where it's going to, and this is really the core of this film. Is about survival. It's about a man rediscovering his humanity among Martians. That's where I'm going to leave it. So I'm going to give you two clips. One's very lengthy. It's going to... I guess I'm done here, right? So you guys are all... You can light whatever you need here. You don't need to know much. This is... I guess you would call this a reciting incident. I don't know. Carter is a Civil War vet, finds himself later in life in Arizona mining for gold. This is in the book. And without giving anything away, he suddenly finds himself projected to Mars. And this is going to be him waking up and what he discovers along the way. Now, none of these shots are finished, although they look quite finished. And so you may be want to judge them down to their little pixel, and believe me, we still are. But it's good enough that I felt like it was worth showing you guys. So we'll show you that first clip.